Let me introduce our speaker tonight. Julie Devil Jack is going to come to the stage. Julie is the Deputy Director of the Centre and is also one of the Centre's founding members. I'd like you to welcome Julie Devil Jack, ladies and gentlemen.
I thought we were just looking high heels on, so I think I might have to bend. It's just a bit too heavy. Okay, that's better. It is my honour and my pleasure to introduce to you our speaker for the evening, Lieutenant Colonel Dan Morrie. After graduating from a military college in 1991, Dan became an officer of the Marine Corps. In 1994, Dan graduated from the Western New England College School of Law in Springfield, Massachusetts, and was then admitted to the bar in Massachusetts. In June 2009, he was promoted to Lieutenant Colonel and made a senior military judge. But the reason why Dan's reputation precedes him in Australia, and for good cause, is the work that he did when he was a major. Most people here will know Dan as Major Morrie. From 2003 to 2007, Major Morrie represented David Hicks, an Australian citizen who was detained at Guantanamo Bay. Major Morrie's defence of David Hicks was fearless and tireless, as is merited for all accused. Major Morrie was not afraid to challenge the fairness of the military system established to try the accused of Guantanamo Bay, both in his home country, the United States, and in Australia. And he did so, even though it was, regardless of the impact it was going to have on his career, or on him personally. And without fatigue, Major Morrie consistently, rationally and eloquently spoke public about the fairness of the system, the charges to be brought, or the fact that there were no charges to be brought for a very long time, and the treatment of the detainees. His efforts did not go unnoticed by many people and organisations around the world, with Dan being presented with numerous awards, including the Roger N. Baldwin Medal of Liberty Award, awarded to him from the American Civil Liberties Union, an honorary membership of the Australian Bar Association for his defence of David Hicks, and a Civil Justice Award from the Australian Lawyers Alliance as recognition by the legal profession for unsung heroes who, despite personal risk or sacrifice, have fought to preserve individual rights, human dignity and safety. It is our fortune that Dan has decided to leave the Marine Corps and Hawaii, I might add, to join us here in Melbourne from 2012 onwards, hopefully. He has joined the team at Shine Lawyers and will bring his sense of justice and passion to bear on the Victorian legal system and the Australian legal system, and he will continue to pursue his interest in international law. I look forward to a long and fruitful relationship between Dan and the Caston Centre, and to a future with Dan Morrie as a professional colleague and personal friend. So I now welcome you, Dan, to the lectern.
Thank you very much, Julie, for that wonderful introduction, and thank you, everybody, for coming today, and I'm just thankful that I got invited to be part of this wonderful celebration of the Caston Center, and obviously to be here in Australia. It's for my wife and my three kids. We've certainly been here since July, and we felt a very warm welcome, and it's made us made Melbourne feel like home for us. So thank you to everybody for that. I got an honorary membership to the bar here, but I can't practice on it. The ALA gave me a certificate and I think a free membership for the rest of my life, but when I moved here, they still sent me a dues fee. it was very nice. And look, I have to always want to start off because I can introduce all you. Very, very nice things are said, but I could never have accomplished what was accomplished without so many people behind the scenes that were thinking the big thoughts, giving the suggestions, doing the research, strategizing, assisting, and there's a lot of people here that are here tonight that were voices, mentors, supporters. Eva Sheerlich is here from the Australian Lawyers Alliance, and she was the CEO at that time. Obviously, the Honourable Peter Vickery was a mentor and a source of international law at that time. Julian Burnside was standing up with me, advocating very fiercely. I came across Sarah Joseph in my time representing Hicks. Former state senator Linda Kirk, is she here? I saw her. She's hiding. She's in the back. One of the very first people from a governmental position to come out and really start advocating and questioning what was being happening to David. And probably many people don't know that. And so thank you, Linda, for your everything you did. And though that we're at the Asia Pacific Center for Military Law table. There were rowdy ones in the back for Melbourne Uni. Tim McCormack and Ozzy and Kathy Hutton. Are you back for Kathy? She had to put up with me all the times coming here and offering support. So I do really, all the nice things you said about me really wouldn't have happened, but for all these other people, and there's probably another 100 out there that I wish I could name and thank. So I realize I'm the only thing standing between you and the main course. I will do my song and dance, but only until 2100, when the food is coming out. The Caston Center is a wonderful organization that it's that intersection between human rights and the law and in trying to stimulate change in the law. From the U.S., I know many of you know or are aware that this is coming up to the 50th anniversary of Gideon v. Wainwright, which was the case that dealt with access to counsel and access to justice. And so I'm really happy to be part of that, the community here, the community legal centers, the pro bono or parts of the law firms here at Chine, and getting an opportunity to start something at Chine and hopefully grow it into something that lasts a while, as long as I can pass admin law. I was asked to give a talk, and it's hard. I'm going to try to take this thing out so you can all hear me. And if you can't hear, please yell at me. I was asked to talk about... come up with something to talk about, and so I titled my topic sort of Reflections on the War on Terror. And obviously one of the glaring things, looking back on this war on terror, right, as from today, is that Guantanamo is still open. I know most of you had a lot of hope for President Obama, right? Change was coming. And there was some change, but I think the reality, his expectations on what he could actually accomplish in closing Guantanamo, the resistance he met within the Department of Defense and within the legislature within the United States was something he might not have been able to anticipate, and he has not been able to overcome that. The second part of my sort of topic was reflection on the war on terror, but I want to call it the mainstreaming of executive-directed killings. Many of you have heard the term extrajudicial killings, targeted killings. I try to coin the term executive directed because I think that really captures what it is. Right? An extrajudicial killing is any killing that happens outside the law. A targeted killing happens in war and it can be lawful or unlawful. But an executive directed killing, that really captures what it really is. It's the executive branch. A member of the executive branch of a government making a factual determination against some self-imposed standard and then using force against someone to punish that person for violating that standard that's not justified by self-defense or defense of another's. Does that definition make sense? Whether you agree with it or not, that's really what it is. It's the executive making that factual determination, not a judiciary, not... And I think that's the issue and one of the legacies on the war on terror, that has somehow become mainstream and accepted in the mainstream. Go back 40 years. There's some of us in the room that were alive 40 years ago. I was only, very young. I remember the Munich Olympics. And I remember the terrible attacks and the 11 Israeli athletes and staff that were killed. But what was the response to that? What was the response to that attack besides the Eric Bana movie? God always had a good Australian actor in our movie. But It was a covert government response, right? And the fact that it had to be covert was a reflection of mainstream mankind's humanity's values. It sort of was also, this is the 70s, the James Bond era. I think this was in the Roger Moore version of James Bond at the time of the 70s. After Sean Connery, I can't remember exactly, I was still young. But, it was sort of not accepted, but understood. Governments may take action, but if you're caught doing this, hey, you can be prosecuted, right? The chips may land with their name, but if you make it back, you're okay. Yeah, somehow, fast forward almost 40 years to 2010, when a Hamas commander is killed in a 5-star hotel in Dubai, and people aren't upset about him being killed in the hotel, but they're upset that passports were misused. What happened in our values in just that period of time, in 40 years? And even now, with the release of the public recognition of the U.S. having kill lists, the release of the No Easy Day book, commenting on the factual basis or raising some questions about the factual basis of the killing of Osama bin Laden. How, really, to where the point is, a leader of a democratic nation is handling the killing of another person as a great success. How, if you read the book, No Easy Day, I read all just the excerpt, and it basically, Osama sticks his head out the door, and bang, he's shot. I'm not quite sure, to me, that sounds like an executive directed killing. There's no self-defense. And this is all a result, I think, of Bush's paradigm shift in the war on terror after 2001. Clearly, the attack of September 11th was a very emotional event, an event that pulled people together and wanted to back the United States and wanted to stand united behind our president. And the Bush administration took full advantage of it to create and twist the law of war so that they could detain, interrogate, try, and kill people under the law of war. And they created this new category of unlawful combatant. The category that allowed the expansive intrusion onto the individual's rights and protections that we expected from the law, such that you could try and kill them, or detain and interrogate them under the law of war. But it also created a special class that, well, they could violate the law of war and kill them in the law of war. They got none of the protections of the law of war. Sort of very, very odd. And I think part of this had to do with the administration's belief that the end justified the means. And that if you bent the rules, or you felt that they didn't apply to you, it was okay. And I submit that it really was a test of the leadership in the Bush administration. It was a test of their moral courage in the face of a public emotional event. But having to deal with such an outrageous crime, this was not the first time that mankind had to deal with it. Think about the emotional struggle facing our country's leaders following World War II. And the crimes that were committed during World War II and preceding it certainly overshadow what happened on September 11th in scale and in magnitude. And while Stalin wanted to go out and shoot 50,000 or 100,000 Germans, as the resolution, mankind and humanity said, no, we had to use trials. And yet, somehow, 60 years later, our values somehow have changed. I think it deals with moral courage. And the Marine Corps Commandant, 1997 General Krulak, the 31st Commandant, commented that moral courage, when required, is the ability to take a stand against what is popular and what might be seen as the easy path. And I submit that following September 11th, there was an easy path and a difficult path. And the Bush administration chose the easy path and the easy path may not be difficult to resist it, because it was had to be the popular choice, and there was a lot of emotion pushing one way. And to resist going down the easy path, I think that's not always an easy challenge. And we only have to look at the headlines, recent headlines. And there was a recent story in Australia, and most of you know about the fall of Lance Armstrong. How do you get Lance Armstrong in the war on terror? Someone asked. I'm going to work him in. It's a challenge, so I'm going to get this. But why would Lance Armstrong do what he did? And I sort of think the same way. Why did the Bush administration, the lawyers advised them, do what they did? Why do people tolerate executive directed killings? Why? And I think it's the pressures we were under to act, sometimes without moral courage in our daily lives, that can be pretty immense. It can be the failure to fail, right? I'm nervous up here. There's a lot of things we all do in our lives. And there's a fear of failure. There's a fear, there's a desire to be successful. There's competitiveness in us, right? I know lawyers are not competitive, right? But those other accountants are, right? You know, there is that. And it's a natural, they're natural sort of emotions that we have. But why would Lance Armstrong do this? And I think it's part of it is, and I'll ask this, who's Scott Mercer? Does anybody know who Scott Mercer is? Of course, nobody does. Why? Because he was part of the U.S. Postal Bicycle Team that said no to using drugs. So nobody knows him. And that's kind of a sad reflection on our societal values. Because you do get there at some time that you're willing to cheat. And I sort of, and the end justified the means, and I think the same thing that Lance Armstrong must have felt, that it was the pressure to be successful and the pressure to compete, and the pressure must have driven him and had that character flaw. It must be the same thing that the Bush administration and their lawyers felt so much pressure to do what they did. But that may answer the reason why we shifted away from the basic protection of human values when it happened. But we've continued across that path away from it, culminating in executive directed killings. I think integrity is at the heart of courage. It's not a light switch, right? Your integrity is not a light switch. It can take years to build a reputation. It can take a day to lose it. It's not a light switch that you can turn on and off, right? It's part of who you are as a person, and we all struggle with it. I had a moral courage challenge a couple days ago. I had to go to Perth. And I was at the airport in Melbourne. What? You don't want to hear the story? You do? And I'm trying to fill time. I'm down south. And my wife sent me an email on my iPhone. Thank God we get email on our iPhones. And it said, "Do you know where the car keys are?" And I put my hand in my pocket. And I had a moral challenge. Because I couldn't send back that reply that says, "No idea," and then when I got back, find them miraculously under the couch. But I didn't. I showed the moral way and said, "Honey, they're in my pocket. I'm sorry." But that's a light example. But there are challenges out there, and I think I just would want to leave that having moral courage is not easy, and you may only be faced with it once in your life to address it, or it may be something that you have to deal with every day, or one of your family members, your loved ones, or someone you're mentoring or being mentored by. But once you cross that line, I think it becomes all too easy to cross it again and again, and I think that's what happened to Lance Armstrong, and I think that's what happened to the Bush administration and the lawyers, that once you cross it without a way with it, you kept doing it. And I do think that on the issue of executive directed killings, that's we really need people to look at and focus on that as a means of warfare. I want to finish with the last quote from our commandant, when he talked again, he gave additional guidance. He said, "Courage acted out in our lives, watches out for the oppressed,
speaks up for the weak, takes a stand against injustice, and does so at our own expense. And I think that's what the Kasten Center is about. Thank you. I'm more than happy to take questions if people have any questions, and I'll just move close so I can repeat it so everyone can hear. Yes, ma'am. Yeah, you should. Did you donate? No, The closing of Guantanamo.
Yes.
Okay, I'll answer that. Because maybe I have to give, I know it's strange because I think Australians watch U.S. politicians and politics more than I do. I see every time you just see what, who was it?
Mitt Romney.
No, not Mitt Romney. Who's the rich guy? Kwaki Hara. Donald Trump. She's like, you see what Donald Trump did? I said, no. I was watching Julie Gillard. Aren't you excited by her? But to answer your question, I think honestly, what the problem was, I think Barack really wanted to take the detainees from Gitmo, try them in U.S. federal courts, get rid of the ones that didn't want. The problem was, there were so many members of our Senate and our House of Representatives, so many people within our Department of Justice, our Department of Defense, our Department of State, their career is attached to Guantanamo, that there was so much resistance to stopping that inertia. And when Obama said Obama and Holder came out and said, we're going to use federal trials for Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, and then Congress said, we're taking away your money to go ahead and bring him here, he met a wall he could not get around. And so I don't want to say that his failure to close Guantanamo is a complete reflection on him. I think it's also a reflection on our government and those that advocated for Guantanamo and protected it for so many years. Does that answer your question? Okay? Maybe not. Yes, sir.
What's your view on the lawyers who defense departments who justified torture and said the waterboarding and everything else wasn't torture?
His question was, what's my opinion on the lawyers that supported the waterboarding and didn't stand up to it? All I know is in 1902, Marines were prosecuted for waterboarding people in the Philippines. You know, it's always been a crime. Somehow, again, I think that the moral courage, and a lot of it had to do with the legal community in the U.S. and the White House, the special counsels, the Department of Defense General Counsel's Office, and then the military judge advocate general leadership, when they first were presented, and this was very early on, are you going to view Article 5 tribunals to determine these people were capturing prisoner of war status? And Rumsfeld said no. And every lawyer in the Department of Defense said, at the upper level, said, okay. And they said, you know, the Geneva Conventions are a claim. That began. They crossed the line. And after that, it was too easy to keep going back. The military on the front line over in Afghanistan, I had a friend on the carriers there, they were setting up to do Article 5 tribunals to determine their prisoner of war status until they were told to stop. So, kind of, I think they crossed the line, and once they did, it was easy to keep going. Yes, one more. Yes, ma'am.
I just wonder how you distinguish between the victims directed killing and the CIA killings that were done in Latin America with the knowledge of the Executive Department.
Well, I would say that is. I would say executive directed killings were going on there. They're part of the Phoenix Project.
They're not new.
Right? I mean, the Phoenix Project, when I was doing the research, we found that, we were killing North Vietnamese sympathizers until Vietnam. And Congress said, you know, it was bad, the investigations, and yet somehow, within the lifetime of the people that attended those hearings, we're back doing it again. So, for some reason, Yeah, just repeating itself.
And it was not the CIA operatives who were brought to trial. It's always some poor sucker Marine who went up on
it. It's true. Or the civilian that they directed or influenced to do whatever. Yeah. It's very hard to hold people careful. Well, I do want to say thank you very much. Thank you very much for inviting me. I look forward to chatting.
Thank you. My name is Paula Gerber and I'm one of the deputy directors of the Cashin Centre. It's my privilege to give a vote of thanks to Major Murray for tonight's presentation. I think the reason you had a bit of laughter about your story from the airport is that when you said you had a moral courage decision, you're at the airport flying to Perth, and most of us thought that the moral courage was that you were going to Perth. So, we may not have a Guantanamo Bay in Australia, but we certainly have many of our own human rights challenges here, and we're absolutely thrilled to have someone with your moral courage here to help us fight for human rights in this country. And a small token of our appreciation is a little book that might help you learn more about Human Rights Australia, hot off the press, Contemporary Perspectives on Human Rights Law in Australia, by Paula Gerber.